total all them things together, and you end up with a frightsome mess that's likely to give you nightmares. But Emma toted it near everywhere but school. She said,
"Afternoon, Mr. Freeman." "Afternoon, old Flapjack." "Afternoon, Elijah."
That's one of the main reasons don't no one like Emma. She thought it was funny to speak to a mule afore she spoke to me. Just like Philip Wise, she ain't never got over that I was the first child born free in Buxton. Ma and Emma's ma were in a race to see who was going to be first born, and Emma didn't come out till 6 days after me. Since me and Ma won the race, Emma's always let the sin of envy choke her heart. Paul pulled his hat off and answered her. I pulled a face. He wiped his forehead and said, "You still seeing him, son?" I patted old Flapjack's flank and kept my head pointed at Paul, but I turned my eyes back to that big maple. There was still one half of a head peeking at us about 3 feet off the ground. It was the boy. "Yes, sir. One of 'em still there." Paul said,
"They's yon, Emma, by that biggest tree direct under the sun."
Emma looked out of the corner of her eye and said, "I see the tree, Mr. Freeman," and started off walking slow away from us. When Mr. Frederick Douglass is speechifying, he says that the second hardest step in making yourself free is the first one that you take. He says after you make up your mind and take the first step, most of the rest of them come pretty easy. But he says that the most hardest step to take is the very last one. He says that finally crossing over from slavery to freedom is the most horrifyingest, most bravest thing a slave will ever have to do. In my eyes, it's odd that Emma Collins is the one who's best at carrying folks that last step into being free. But truth told, could no one else do it near as good as her? Ma says it's 'cause Emma's a lot like me. Well, she don't mean that in a good way, 'cause Emma can't chuck stones worth spit, nor tend to animals so's they're happy like I can. And I ain't nowhere near as good as her in my studies and schoolwork. Ma means we're alike 'cause Emma's fragile too. But she's a whole lot more fragiler than I ever been. And whilst you'd have to study me real hard to see it, with Emma, it's something that's plain and right out front. Fragileness is sitting on her bold as one of them awful flowery church hats Ma and the other women wear on Sunday. But the fragileness does make it easy to tell that Emma don't mean no one no harm, and that makes the runaways more comforted once they see her. Emma Collins didn't make no beeline for the big maple. She kind of zigged one way, then zagged another, moving slow, but always ending up going in the direction of the tree. It looked to be a whole lot of lollygagging in a walk that should have took about a minute to make, ended up taking a whole lot longer. But she knew what she was doing. She bended over to pull up a yellow flower, acted like she was showing it to that terrific doll, moved on a bit, squatted down to lift up a rock to see what was underneath, put the doll's face close to the ground so's it could get a good look too, moved on some more, twirled and spun round a couple times, moved on a little more, brushed something off the doll's dress, and afore you could say how she did it, she'd wandered right up next to the big maple. That was when she finally quit moving and looked dead at the tree. I'd know she was talking gentle to whoever it was that thought hadn't no one seen him. She was too far off and talked too soft for me to hear, but I knowed she was saying, "Hello, my name's Emma Collins. I'm the first girl who was born free in Buxton, and now you're free too. We're very pleased you are going to be our new neighbors. Come. Everybody's waiting to meet you."
Emma finished her speechifying and reached her right hand out toward the tree. Did nothing move for the longest time. Then, slow as can be,
a man came out from behind the maple, holding on to his hat. He talked a bit, pulled his hat back on, then dropped on one knee and reached his hand out to Emma. Emma took a hold of his hand. He stood up, and she commenced walking the man right to us. I said, "She's got him." And Paul finally looked over and waved. The man didn't return Paul's wave or nothing. One of his hands was holding on to Emma, and the other one was behind his back. He was looking side to side and all round, seeming like he was about to bolt if someone said boo. When he was about 20 paces from us, the man turned Emma's hand loose, pulled off his hat, and called to Paul.
"Pardon me, sir. The child, right? This here, really Buxton?" "Morning. Yes, sir, it is. And y'all's really free."
The man wrung his hand from behind his back. He was clutching onto a long, shining knife. He looked at it, then back at Paul, and it seemed like he was fixing to cry. He turned the knife so's he was hanging on to the blade and said,
"I's terrible sorry about this here dagger, sir, but..."
He wiped out his eyes.
"But we's so tired of running. We's come so..."
He couldn't talk no more. Paul walked right up on him and wrapped his arms round the man and said,
"Don't say nothing more, brother. I know it ain't been easy, but you found where you're supposed to be. Your home. You alone?"
The man said,
"No, sir."
Turned back toward the maple and whistled, then waved both his arms over his head. A woman, a boy, and a girl, hanging on to one another's hands, stepped out of the woods and started heading slow toward us. They were walking low, and their heads were ducking and shooting from side to side, just like the man's had been. Instead of taking the direct way to us, they skirted along the woods and the part of Mrs. Holton's land that Mr. Leroy had already cleared. The woman was toting a bundle tied to her back. I knowed it was a baby, 'cause it was tied the same way all the settlement women do when they're working and want to keep their children with them. About halfway across, they broke away from the tree line and started moving faster and faster through the clearing toward us. Their mouths were pulled wide open like they were fixing to scream, but didn't no sounds come from them. After a second, they started running all out, acting like the devil himself was on their tail. Then they commenced making a sound that made my skin all twitchy with goose flesh. It weren't like no human sound at all. It was a kind of wail, and a moan, and a yell all stirred up together. It was something terrible to hear. The man threw the knife down and ran out at him. They crashed one into the other so hard, you'd think they'd have knocked each other over. But they didn't. They stood all knotted together, keeping up those horrible noises, and holding on like there wasn't no tomorrow. They acted like they hadn't seen one another in 100 years, instead of just a minute or two. The little boy, who appeared to be about 5 years old, was blubbering and turning his legs up and down like he was still on the run, but he weren't moving nowhere. He was running in one spot, clutching onto his mother's and father's legs. It must have shooked him up bad to see his ma and pa crying and looking wild and carrying on like this, 'cause all of a sudden, the front of his breeches started getting covered with a dark stain. I had to turn my head so as not to shame him. I looked over at Emma, and doggone it all, she was squeezing that awful doll and started to pull her lip down and cloud her eyes up, getting ready to bawl right along with the new free folks. I'll be blanged if bawling ain't something akin to the measles or the chicken pox or the plague. Once it grabs a hold of one fragile person, seems like it snatches on to every other fragile person that's anywhere near. I've been working hard to fight it, but I didn't have no choice but to commence crying right along with Emma and them. Pa and Cooter didn't try to shame me or nothing. Cooter looked at his shoes, and Pa looked at me. His shoulders dropped some, and he allowed a long, slow breath to come out of him. It looked a lot like disappointment, but at least he didn't say nothing. The woman broke away from the others and ran hard at Paul, unwrapping the baby off her back and holding it out front of her. She said,
"Sir, my baby girl's sick."
She showed the baby to Paul, and he said,
"We got some nurses what'll tend your child, ma'am. How long she been ailing?"
The woman said,
"She ain't woke up since yesterday morning. 2 nights ago, there were some paddy rollers right on top of us. She always been a quiet child, but since we been running, she been likely to bawl. So I had to give her some of this, else they'd have caught us for sure. I ain't had no choice, but I was afraid I gave her too much."
She pulled a brown tonic bottle out of her dress pocket. Paul said,
"She drawin' breath strong. We gets lots of young'uns what's had too much sleep medicine, and all them done good after a while."
The man and the 2 children bunched up round the woman and the sleepy baby. Paul unharnessed the chains off of old Flapjack and tied them to the stump we'd been pulling on. Paul walked back over to the family and said the same thing we say to all the new free folks when they first get to Buxton. It's the way we greet them into being free. Paul pointed up and said,
"Look at there. Look at that sky."
I heard Paul and other grown folks say this plenty of times, but I couldn't help but follow where Paul's finger was pointing. Everybody did. We all looked up at the blue sky that didn't have cloud the first in it.
"Ain't that the grandest sky y'all ever seen?"
Paul smiled and pointed out across the field.
"Look at that land. Look at them trees. Has y'all ever seen anything that precious? It's the land of the free."
The family kept following where Paul was pointing.
"Now look at yourselves. Look at them babies. Has y'all ever looked this beautiful? Today be the first day don't no one own y'all but y'all. Today be the first day that don't no one own them babies. Today be the first day you ain't got cause to blame no one for what gonna happen to you tomorrow. Today, y'all's truly set yourselves free."
Then he opened both his arms and said to the people,
"And y'all choose the most beautifulest, most perfectest day for doing it. Only thing I's got to ask is, what kept you?"
It was peculiar, 'cause it didn't matter if it was raining or snowing or even if the sky was being ripped by lightning and thunder. We always would tell the new folks that it was the most beautifulest, most perfectest day to get free. Far as I can tell, the weather didn't have a whole lot to do with it. Paul said,
"Come on, we gonna go into the settlement and let everyone know y'all made it. Gouda, Emma, Elijah, y'all come too. Leave the mule. We ain't gonna be long gone."
Paul and Cuda and the new people started out toward the road. Fragileness is mighty embarrassing, even if you're a girl. So me and Emma both hang back a little to get the sniffling out of us. Emma set her doll and the little yellow flower on the stump and pulled out a kerchief to wipe her eyes and nose. I've had it explained to me plenty of times, but I ain't never gonna understand the purpose of having a piece of cloth made just for blowing your nose into. Seems real dirty and nasty to me. Makes a whole lot more sense to me to plug up one of your nose holes and just blow what you gotta blow out of the other one onto the ground. Least that way you ain't constantly toting no dried up things from your nose round in your pockets. But Ma's always telling me not to do that, especially round respectable folks. Far as I can tell, Emma ain't the least bit respectable. But for Ma's sake, instead of blowing my nose onto the ground, I bloated into my shirt sleeve. Emma gave me a dirty look, and I gave her one right back. I remembered the knife that the man dropped and left in the field. I picked it up and ran to catch up with Paul and them. I said, "Sir, you forgot this." I reached the knife at him. Him and the woman looked at one another and soured up their faces. He said, "Well, thank you, boy. But we's free now. I don't want to see that dagger never no more." I couldn't help but be surprised. The man said to Paul, "Sir, I swore it wasn't no one gonna take us back lest it be over my dead body. I swore it, and I proved it wasn't no bluff. But now, there ain't no more need for that dagger. There ain't no more need to be thinking about the dirt wet all over it. It's sullied. It ain't clean." I looked at the knife. It looked like the blacksmith had just got done making it. I said, "But sir, it looks like it's new. It ain't dirt at all. It looks like..." Paul told me, "Elijah, put the knife in your tote sack and be still." He said to the man, "Don't worry, sir. I'm going to take care of the knife." I hoped Paul was going to tell me what this meant later, but I knowed by the way he done everything quick-like that I shouldn't say nothing more about it for now. I took a rag out of my tote sack and wrapped the knife in it so it wouldn't bang up against one of my chunking stones. We started back up walking, and Emma zigged and zagged her way up to the new free girl. The little girl acted like Emma was a haint and hugged in closer to the boy with the wet trousers. Emma smiled at the girl and tried to hand her the yellow flower she'd picked. The girl looked at the flower, then at Emma, but still held on to her brother. Then Emma stuck the flower down in that terrific doll's apron and reached the two of them out to the new free girl. The girl kept gripping her brother with one hand, but raised the other one slow to take the doll. Once she got a hold of it, she hugged it into herself hard, staring at Emma. Emma said, "Her name's Birdie. I suppose you can call her anything you want to, but she's always liked the name Birdie best. She's kind of shy, so she wants me to ask if you'd mind being her new ma." The girl looked long and hard into the doll's brown eyes, then smiled, like she saw something there besides a couple of buttons and some thread. She shook her head up and down and moved her mouth like she was saying, "Thank you, ma'am." Emma smiled and said, "You're welcome." I might have said something, welcoming to the boy, but I learned from it happening to me personal that if you wet your pants in front of a bunch of strangers, you don't really want no one talking to you. You don't want no one asking why you walking stiff-legged or doing nothing that would draw no attention to yourself. My keeping quiet weren't from being ignorant and unwelcoming. It was done so as not to shame him. Besides, after he got done walking all the way to the settlement with that pee chafing round in his pants rubbing him raw, he wasn't going to want to talk at all. Coulda said to me, "They's the first new free in 4 months, Eli. You done the last ones, so it's my go to ring these here folk in." Coulda was right. I had runned in the last new free people, so it was his turn now. I said, "Paul?" He said, "Y'all run on ahead." Me and Coulda both said, "Yes, sir," and tore it off toward the settlement. Near everyone in Buxton who could would come a-running once we started tolling the Liberty Bell.
Chapter 12. The Secret Language of Being Groaned.
Me and Coulda ran all the way back to the schoolhouse using the best shortcuts so we'd get there long before Paul and Emma and the new folks. Paul would walk 'em slow along the road, talking to him gentle, and starting to get him used to the way we do things in Buxton. Weren't no one in the schoolhouse on a Saturday, so me and Cuda opened the door and headed to the steeple to ring the Liberty Bell. The Liberty Bell ain't no regular schoolhouse bell. It's a 500-pound bell that came all the way from America. Not nowhere as close as Michigan, America, neither. It's from a city called Pittsburgh, far, far down in the United States. And we didn't have to pay nothing for it. It was gave to us by other folks that used to be slaves. It took them a whole bunch of years, but they saved up every penny they could and had the Liberty Bell made, then sent all the way to Canada. And these were poor folks, too. But they were so proud of us that they didn't mind doing without some things so's we could have the bell. They wanted it to be something that we'd always hear and see to remind folks in Buxton that prayers from America were always right alongside us. They even had words writ onto the bell so's we'd never forget who gave it to us. It said, "Presented to Reverend King by the colored inhabitants of Pittsburgh for the Academy at Raleigh, Canada West. Let freedom ring." Raleigh is what some people who don't live here call the settlement. Whenever new free folks come to live in Buxton, we ring the bell 20 times for each one of them, 10 times to ring out their old lives, and 10 more to ring in their new ones, their free lives. Then we ask the new free folks to, one by one, climb the ladder of the steeple and rub the bell with their left hand. Most times when you're doing something important, you're supposed to use your right hand. But we ask them to use their left hand because it's closest to their hearts. Mr. Frederick Douglass said he hopes so many people get freed and mash their hands onto the Liberty Bell that a shiny spot bright as gold gets worn into the brass. But so far, that hasn't happened. Anyone in the settlement that hears the ringing quits doing whatever they're doing and comes to the schoolhouse to welcome the new people. Then, if the new free folks say they want to live in the settlement, everyone decides where they'll stay till they get their own place and get comforted about being amongst us. There's always a box full of cotton in the school steeple so you can stuff your ears whilst you're ringing the bell. It's loud enough that you'd be hearing it and nothing else for the longest if you didn't shove something in your ears. Me and Cuda jammed our ears up tight. Cuda said, "So how many times I gotta ring it?" I said, "What?" Cuda yelled, "How many times I gotta ring it?" Multiplying something by 20 is easy. You just double it, then add on a zero. I said, 5 doubled equals 10. Then adding a zero to 10 equals 100. Cuda said, "Eh?" I told him louder. Cuda said, "You sure? Don't seem like it should be that much." I said, "What?" Cuda said, 100 sound like way too much rings." I spread and closed my fingers 10 times and said, "Nope. Look. 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100. Cuda said, "I guess that's right, but it sure do seem like a lot. Eh?" Cuda yelled, "You's better than me at some, so I'ma listen to you." He jumped up to pull the rope and get the bell ringing. Since he was the one who was doing the ringing, I had to do the counting so whoever was listening would know how many people got free. Dong! I yelled, "One!" The first ring was always the weakest. It weren't till about 5 or 6 rings that the bell got tolling real good. Dong! 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 2, 3, 4. It weren't long before we got to 96. Dong, 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 dong. 97, 98, 99, 100!
By the time me and Cooter were done, there were already some people standing outside the schoolhouse waiting to welcome the people that Paul was walking in. Miss Carolina, Mr. Waller, Miss Duncan the First, and her sister, Miss Duncan the Second, and Mr. Polite all said, "Morning, Cooter. Morning, Eli." Cooter said, "Pardon me." Mr. Polite said,
"I told you morning."
I said, "Excuse me, sir?" Mr. Polite yelled, "If you two cabbage heads don't take that cotton out your ears, I don't know what I'm gonna do to y'all." Me and Cooter pulled the cotton out. Miss Carolina said, "How many folks was that, Elijah? 9, 10? "No, ma'am. There's just 5 of them. A man, a woman, a girl, a boy, and a sick baby." Mr. Polite said,
"Only 5? You sure you doing your counting right, boy? Much as y'all rung that bell, I was expecting to come down here and see that half of Tennessee done got away."
"No, sir. That was only 100 times for 5 people." Cooter said,
"I told him that. I told him it seemed like 100 was too much for just 5 people."
I said, "But it ain't. 5 times 20 equals 100. I started spreading my fingers to count it off again, but before I could even get to 40, Paul and the new free folks turned up the road, heading toward the schoolhouse. Emma Collins and the little girl were each holding on to one of the arms of that blang birdie doll, swinging it twixt them to and fro.
Paul said, "Morning, y'all. This here's the Taylors. Just come up from Arkansas. Been hearing about us for the longest. The baby gonna need some tending."
It was okay to rush up on him now that Paul and Emma had settled him down some. Everybody quit fussing with me and went right up to where Paul and the new people were standing. Folks that had been farther out while she rung the bell started showing up. Ma and Mrs. Guest came in too. The new people were looking lost and confused and shy, so many of us came up on them and patted them on the back and shook their hands and welcomed them to Buxton. Mrs. Guest took the woman and her baby to the infirmary. Ma looked at the boy and pulled him away. I knowed the next time I saw him, he'd be smelling like powder and wearing an old pair of my breeches. I knowed that even with that, it was going to be a while before he weren't walking stiff-legged. Then things got real confusing, because instead of greeting the people and making them feel comforted the way it happens most times, Miss Duncan the First started up asking questions. She held Emma's new friend's face in her hand and said to her sister, Miss Duncan the Second, "Dot, I know you weren't but 8, and it been 15 years, but who this child bring to mind?" Miss Duncan the Second studied the little girl, then said, "She don't look like no one I know. Who you talking about?" Miss Duncan the First said, "How old is you girl?" The little girl pulled Bertie's arm away from Emma and hugged back up on her father. The man said, "Don't be shy, Lucille. She ain't but 6. She little for her age. Who she favor?" Miss Duncan the First said to the man, "What your woman name be?" The man said, "Eliza. Eliza Taylor, ma'am." Miss Duncan the First said, "Y'all married?"
"Yes, ma'am. 7 years.
"What her name before she got married?"
"She was a Jones, ma'am."
"Whereabouts she from?"
"Fort Smith, Arkansas, ma'am."
"She born there?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Who her mama?"
"Well, she never knowed her, ma'am."
"Who raised her?"
"Her auntie."
"Her auntie by birth?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Her auntie ain't told her who her mama is?"
"No, ma'am."
Miss Duncan the Second said, "How come she ain't told her?" Mr. Taylor looked at the women and frowned. He looked like he was fixing to say something, but Miss Duncan the First jumped in and said, "What she know about North Carolina?"
"Well, she don't know nothing about it. At least she ain't never said nothing."
Miss Duncan II looked back at the little girl and all of a sudden slapped both her hands over her ears. Her mouth jumped open and she appeared to be dumbstruck. Miss Duncan I said, "Sir, judging by the look of your daughter, I knows your wife. I swear I do. But her name be Alice, not Liza." Miss Duncan II looked stupefied. She pulled her hands off of her ears and whispered, "No, it can't be. That woman looked too old. Alice ain't no more than 26 by now." Mr. Taylor said, "No, ma'am, you's mistaken. We ain't exactly sure how old Liza be. She got 5 children elsewhere, and the oldest one about 14 years old. Liza's somewhere twixt 35 and 40, near as we can figure. But she ain't no young woman. She can't be no 26. Miss Duncan I said to Mr. Taylor, "She is that young. She done birth. Emma, how much do 5 and 3 come to?" Emma said, 5 plus 3 equals 8, Miss Duncan I. Miss Duncan I said, "She done birth 8 children since she wasn't nothing but a baby herself. That's why she be looking that old." She said to Mr. Taylor, "She got a scar like a sliver of the moon on her left shoulder would run over and down on her chest." It wasn't a question. Mr. Taylor sucked in air and stared hard. He pulled his daughter to him and said, "What'd you know about that?" "She got burnt when she pulled a frying pan down on herself when she wasn't but 4 years old. Her real name be Alice Duncan. She born in Ajax County, North Carolina. Her and our brother Caleb got sold away 15 years past. Your wife's our baby sister." "Do she know where Caleb at?"
"No, ma'am. Far as we knowed, she ain't got no kin but her auntie. This gonna come as a mighty shock to her." Then things got real, real confusing. Cause instead of Miss Duncan I screaming "Hallelujah" or "Praise be" or something else full of joyfulness that you'd think she'd scream, she said, "Please, sir, don't say nothing about this to her till we's had some time to think on how we gonna let her know. She gone through enough without being burdened with this." He said, "Thank you, ma'am. I was thinking the same thing. This just gonna be a disturbing that she don't need right now." This was another one of those confusions that got me wondering if I'd ever have sense enough to be groaned. About the only thing I could say for sure is that being grown don't make a whole lot of sense. Maybe that's why it takes so long for you to grow up. Maybe enough time's got to go by for all the sense to get worn right out of you. If it was me that just got freed out of America and ran all those miles and ended up finding one of my sisters, I'd have been so happy I'd have busted. But not the grown folks. Whilst Miss Duncan I had been asking Mr. Taylor all those questions, it seemed like every grown-up that was listening had their face getting longer and longer and their foreheads getting more and more wrinkled. I could understand part of the reason. Paul's always telling me how being in America is unbelievable hard for slaves. He says it seems don't no one get out of America without paying some terrible cost, without having something bad done permanent to them, without having something cut off of them, or burnt into them, or ate up inside of them. Maybe that's why when grown folks see someone who's long lost, they don't get riled about it much as a young person would. Maybe it ain't nothing but being afeard they're going to have to hear about all the bad things a person they loved had went through whilst knowing there weren't nothing they could do about it. Maybe all the sad things neath the scars and burns and the pieces that were missing off of their kin were stories best not looked at too hard. This thinking like a grown person was starting to be sensical. Doggone it all.
Chapter 13 Mail from America.
One of my favoritest chores is going to Chatham to check on the mail. It's not something that happens regular, because we have our own post office here in Buxton. But every once in a while, the mail won't come for 2 or 3 weeks, and someone's got to go find out why. It's one of my favoritest chores, but that's only true if I'm allowed to take old Flapjack instead of one of the saddle horses. Even when those horses are walking slow, they're still too fast for my taste. On Wednesday, right after school, Paul told me to go straight to Chatham for the mail. He didn't come right out and say to take a horse, so when I got to the stable, I asked Mr. Segee for old Flapjack. I knowed it weren't right, but it didn't seem like it was wrong, neither. It was kind of middling twixt the two. Me and old Flapjack went for 2 miles out of Buxton, going slow and easy toward Chatham, when I started wishing I shied away from the wrong and gone more to the right. Old Flap gave one of them snorts that let me know he sensed something dangerous. He even kicked his front heels off the ground instead of his rear ones, something I didn't know he could do. I grabbed a hold of his mane and looked hard at the woods. I couldn't see nothing at first. Maybe old Flap had smelt something wrong. Then, for the second time, he did the trick he'd just learned. The first time was practice. Now he was better at it. He throwed his front heels up so high that I slid right off his haunches. Me and my tote sack and the empty mail bag spilled out onto the road. I didn't hurt nothing, but soon as I jumped back up, Flapjack did another trick I had never seen him do before. He started running. It was real stiff-legged and clumsy-looking, but no other word but running would come to mind. Ain't nothing in the world more disturbing than watching your mule, who you thought was one of your best friends, try to gallop away after dumping you in the road so as you could get at by whatever it was that got him so afeared. I grabbed my tote sack and pulled 3 chunking stones out. I turned to the woods ready to throw, but weren't nothing there. Whatever scared old Flapjack must have took off soon as I hit the dirt. I looked a little farther down the road and saw old Flapjack had decided he weren't too fond of running. He'd quit and gone over in the field to chew on something. I ran to him, gentled him down some, then climbed back on top. We started back toward Chatham. But this was a trip that weren't meant to be. 'Twern't but 5 minutes later that Mr. Polite came out of the woods, holding on to the necks of 3 pheasants and a shotgun. "Afternoon, Mr. Polite."
"Afternoon, Elijah. Where about you headed?"
"I'm going to Chatham."
"What for?"
"To check on the mail, sir."
"Not on that worthless mule, you ain't. You head right on back to that stable and tell Clarence Segee to give you Conqueror or Jingle Boy. I've been expecting a package from Toronto, and I needs to have it afore the 20th century gets here."
"Yes, sir."
I turned old Flapjack back towards Buxton to trade him for one of those doggone horses. When me and Jingle Boy got to Chatham, we went right to their post office. I tied the horse out front, waited for my insides to quit shaking, then stepped onto the stoop. I pulled on the doorknob and near about jerked my shoulder out. The door was locked, which was mighty peculiar, 'cause it couldn't have been much past 4 o'clock. It weren't till then that I saw the sign someone stuck up in the window. "Closed until the 5th. Any inquiries, see George at the dry goods store." I went next door to McMahon's Dry Goods. The place had a great smell. It was fresh cured leather and new material mixed up with fancy powder and soap. When you opened the screen door, a bell rung to let people know you were there. It rung again when you left so as folks knowed you were gone. The white man that was folding up sheets of cloth for women's dresses behind the counter looked up at me.
"Why, hello, Elijah. How are you?"
"A fine, thank you, Mr. McMahon.
And what can I do for you today, laddie?"
"I learnt a long time ago that Mr. McMahon didn't mean nothing bad when he called you laddie. It sure sounded like he was mispronouncing lady, but we got told to ignore it. I'm here about our mail, sir. The sign said come talk to you. Leastways, that's what I hoped it said. Inquiries was one of them words that I ain't got notion the first about.
Oh, I was wondering when someone from Buxton would come. Then you haven't heard what happened?
No, sir.
Hey, laddie, we've had to find a new postman. Larry Butler had an absolutely terrible accident.
When Mr. McMahon said words like terrible, he made it sound like they had 7 or 8 R's in them instead of just one.
What happened, sir? As near as we can figure, his horse threw him and trampled him. Hoof caught him right in the head.
This was more proof that a mule was way better than a horse. If Mr. Butler had been riding old Flapjack, he'd still be delivering mail. Mr. McMahon said,
Give me one more minute, Elijah. I know there is a package in the post office, and perhaps a letter or two.
Not much.
Yes, sir.
He finished folding the cloth and picked up his crutches to take me back to the post office. A long time ago, Mr. McMahon had a bad run-in with a horse himself. That's why his right leg ended at his knee instead of at his foot. When he was on his crutches, he moved real graceful and smooth. He'd been without that leg for so long that it looked like the crutches were a part of his body. It almost looked like he was dancing when he walked. When we got inside the post office, Mr. McMahon hefted a box into the shelf, then looked in the mailbag that had Buxton writ across the front.
Seems to be only one package and one letter, Elijah. I could have swore there was more.
He handed me the letter.
Thank you, sir. Someone's going to have to come pick up the mail until the 5th. The new man should be up and running by then.
Yes, sir. Tell Mr. Butler I'm sorry about his accident.
Thanks for the kind words, laddie. Wouldn't matter much what we told him. His mind isn't amongst us anymore.
Mr. McMahon danced to the door, then locked up behind us. He went over to Jingle Boy and patted him on the neck.
Most beautiful horse I've ever seen, Elijah. Hard to believe he's so fast.
He is, sir. I lifted the box into the saddle, then jumped up myself. What was seeing all the damage horses had done in Chatham, and being natural nervous about being up this high, I didn't look to see who the letter was to until we were halfway back to Buxton. My heart sunk when I saw what was writ across the front in proper letters. Mrs. Emmeline Holton, Negro Settlement at Raleigh, Canada West. On the back, above the red wax seal, it said, Applewood, Fairfax County, Virginia, United States. This was trouble. Didn't nothing good ever come out of one of these letters from America? If the words on the envelope were written regular old plain letters that looked like someone had fought hard and long to get the writing down, most times it meant that some person who was a slave had snucked it out, and it was full of rotten news. It was going to tell about a father getting sick, or a brother getting whooped bad, or a mother's children getting sold away. If the letter was writ fancy, like this one was, with swirlingness and curlicues and such nonsense, it only meant one thing. A friendly white person was writing to let you know somebody was dead. Since this letter was addressed to Mrs. Holton, it probably had some bad news about her husband. My ride back from Chatham weren't a good one. It weren't that the road had gone bad, or the skeeters were heavier than they were afore, or that Jingle Boy was bouncing more than regular. But the fancy red envelope in the pouch made the ride home long and sad. I left Mr. Polite's package on his stoop, then took Jingle Boy back to Mr. Segee. Instead of taking the letter direct to Mrs. Holton, I walked back home with it to see what Ma was going to say. I pulled my brogans off and went in through the front door. Ma? She weren't in the parlor.
Ma!
No upstairs in her bedroom.
Ma!
Nor my bedroom.
Ma!
Nor the kitchen. There was one of her peach pies on the kitchen table cooling, and I thought for a second about lifting a piece of the crust and digging a couple of peaches out of it with my finger. Then I thought better of it. I pulled my socks off and went out the back door. Ma was squatted down tending to her truck patch. She saw me and smiled, and was just about to say hello. Ma's are some amazing and scary people. Seems like they got ways of seeing things that ain't showing, and hearing things that ain't being said. I didn't even open my mouth, but Ma knew by some mystery way that something weren't right. She quick stood up and said, "Lijah, what's wrong?" The trowel she'd been using and a fistful of weeds fell out of her hand. "What happened?" She ran up to me, and I showed her the letter from America. She wiped her hands on her coveralls and said, "You see, I ain't got my spectacles on. Who it to? Who it from?" All the grown folks that had never learnt to read nor write whilst they were slaved in America had to take lessons at the schoolhouse at night. Between cooking and cleaning and gardening and sewing and knitting and working the fields at harvest time and helping out at the chopping bees and the raisin bees and tending to her sheep and shearing them and gathering wool and carding it and spinning it, Ma had been lazy and was slacking off on her school lessons, and they weren't sticking particular good. I told her what was written on the envelope, and she said, "Oh, no, 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 no. Don't it never end." Ma didn't waste no time. She said, "Go get your Sunday clothes on, Lijah. We gonna go together to tell her." I knowed I was going to have to read the letter out loud to Mrs. Holton, too. She was taking lessons with Ma, and I don't mean no disrespect to Mr. Travis, but it appeared he was having a powerful bad time in making his lessons stick with any of the grown folks. I changed to my Sabbath school clothes and walked into the parlor. Ma had already put on her Sunday dress and was carrying that pie she'd baked. She said, "Good thing I baked this here pie. I hate to go for something like this bare hand." She set the pie down and opened her arms. I walked in, and she kissed the top of my head and mashed her cheek there. Her voice and the warmness from her face both spread across the top of my head. "Now, Lijah, you know you most likely gonna be breaking some bad news to Mrs. Holton, so don't forget. I'ma need you to be strong. I'ma need you not to rile her and them girls up none by crying and carrying on, sweetie. And I'm especially need you not to go tearing out of Mrs. Holton's home screaming if this here is bad news. Can you do it? I know it ain't a child's place to feel this way about the person that raised you, but I was disappointed in Ma, something awful. She hadn't took no notice that I'd been doing a lot of growing in the past couple of weeks. 'Twern but the other day, I was eavesdropping and heard her tell Paul that it's a miracle I weren't born in slavery, 'cause I'm way too fragile to have survived even a minute of it. Maybe I used to be a little fragile, but I ain't been afeard of nonsense nor run off screaming about the littlest things for the longest time. And besides, it just ain't right to be calling somebody fragile nohow. Can I count on you to be grown, Lijah?" "Yes, ma'am." It was gonna be hard, though. Don't nothing seem to make you want to tear up and cry more than being told not to. I was even starting to feel something loosening up and slopping around in my nose. Ma kissed the top of my head again and turned me loose. We started out toward Mrs. Holton's place. Miss Duncan the first and Miss Duncan the second were tending their flower garden out front of their home. Miss Duncan the first saw us and stood up and called, "Sarah, what's wrong? What happened?" Miss Duncan the second stood up too. She said, "Sarah." Ma told him, "Lijah done pick up a letter from Mrs. Holton. It come from down home." Both the women wiped their hands on their skirts, and Miss Duncan the second said, "Hold on. We's coming with you." That poor, poor thing. By the time we got to Mrs. Holton's home, what started out with me and Ma in a letter had turned into a whole parade of people. There were 12 of us. Me, 3 babies, and 8 women that were all carrying something to eat. There were pies and cornbread and chicken livers and ham and dandelion greens and grits. There weren't a whole lot of talking going on as we walked to Mrs. Holton's. When we got there, Ma pushed me forward onto the stoop to knock. There weren't nothing but a screen door to keep horseflies out. The main door was open, and I could look right into the parlor. I knocked, and Penelope and Cicely, Mrs. Holton's girls, looked up at me from where they were playing on the floor. They smiled when they saw it was me. Mrs. Holton got up out of her chair. She was holding the same reading primer that I'd studied from 5 years past. She smiled at me and said, "Why, lo, Elijah. Mr. Leroy ain't working yet. My goodness, how come you's in your Sunday?" She opened the door, and her breathing got stuck in her throat for a minute when she saw the bunch on her stoop. She said, "Oh. Oh." The primer slipped out from her fingers and landed on the stoop's wood floor. I handed it back to her. She smiled at everyone and said, "Welcome. Y'all come on in." We all pulled off our shoes and walked in. She had her parlor set up just as nice as on. There was a table and a rocking chair and a bench and a big brick fireplace and maple wood floors and rugs. She said, "I'm sorry there ain't enough chairs, but please make yourselves comforted best way y'all can." She turned to her 2 children and told them, "Y'all go on in the garden and pick Mama some flowers. Make sure you bring me some of them pretty purple and white ones." The oldest girl said, "But Ma, you said they ain't ready to be picked yet." Mrs. Holton said, "I think they's ready now, Penelope." Penelope said, "Good afternoon, y'all." Then asked her mother, "Why are all these folks visiting us?" Mrs. Holton said, "Ain't nothing to worry about, darling. Now do as I say. Stay till I calls you, and don't leave the yard." She gave both of the girls a hug and a kiss. Penelope held on to Cicely's hand and took her out through the front door. "Can I offer y'all something?" Ma said, "Thank you kindly, Sister Holton, but Lijah done pick up a letter for you in Chatham. It from down home." Mrs. Holton told me, "Elijah, could you read it for me?" She waved the primer she was studying from. "I ain't too far along in my lessons." Miss Duncan the first put her hand on the rocking chair and said, "Why don't you get off your feet, Sister Holton?" "I'm fine, Miss Duncan. Really, I am. But thank you kindly. Elijah?" I started opening the letter, but before I could get my finger in it and bust the wax seal open, she said, "If you don't mind, Elijah, I wants to open it." "I don't mind at all, ma'am." She picked the wax off the envelope and put it in the front pocket of her apron. She pulled the letter out. She looked it over, then handed it back to me. I said, "It was writ about a year ago, Mrs. Holton." I looked the letter over and knowed I was going to have to sound some of the words out. I read, "My dearest Emmeline, I'm hoping that this letter find you and the children in good health. We hear many wonderful things about the Negro settlement there, and are grateful that God, in His infinite mercy and wisdom, has seen fit to provide you and yours a refuge." Mrs. Holton stopped me. I was afeard she was upset 'cause I stumbled on some of the words, but that weren't it at all. She looked the envelope over and said, "I believe this here's Miss Poole's handwriting. She do like prettying up what she say. You gonna have to tell me what some of them words is, Elijah. What refuge mean?" I know that from Sabbath school. I said, "Refuge means it's somewhere that's safe." She nodded her head. I started back up reading. "However, I'm afraid this missive is not one of glad tidings. I'm afraid I have some tragic news I must tell you." I stopped to see if Mrs. Holton needed any more explaining, but she didn't. I was glad, 'cause I didn't have notion the first what missive meant. After a harsh, forced journey to Applewood, John was brought back into servitude, much to our horror, to set an example, and in retaliation for the gold he claims John stole, Mr. Tillman exacted a punishment so severe that due to the rigors of the march home, John's body could not endure, and he went to the loving arms of our Savior on the 7th day of the 5th month, in the year of our Lord, 1859. He is resting peacefully in the slave burial grounds, and we made certain he had a Christian service and paid $15 for a marked grave. I am sorry to have to burden you with such news. You and the children are in our prayers. If you are so disposed to remunerate me for this expense, please forward the money to me at Applewood. Sincerely, Mrs. Jacob Poole." Mrs. Holton stood there. It didn't seem like none of those 8 women looked direct in her face, but I knowed they were all ready to jump in case she had a fainting spell or went fragile. But Mrs. Holton didn't flinch or nothing. She said to me,
"Read that part again, please, Elijah. That part about John getting punished."
I cleared my throat and read, "Mr. Tillman exacted a punishment so severe that due to the rigors of the march home, John's body could not endure." She raised her hand. I got ready to tell her that I was middling good at reading words, but lots of times I didn't know what they meant. But she shook her head back and forth and said, "His body could not endure. That sure enough is a gentle way of putting it when one man done killed another one with a whip." Mrs. Holton smiled at the women and said,
"Thank y'all kindly for your care. But I'm gonna be all right. I knowed
already. I've been left kind of hanging since we got here, but now, all I hopes is that he felt we got through. Spite of what Miss Poole say, that be the only thing what would make John rest peaceful. I hope he felt the joy and love y'all done give us this past year." She gave a little snuffle, and I thought for sure she was fixing to cry, but she just said, "I hope he knowed how beautiful his girls look when they free." Mrs. Holton sat down in the rocker and said, "He wouldn't have wanted no heavy mourning, and I love him enough to honor that, so I'ma be all right." The women started in with touching Mrs. Holton and saying a lot of "sorry" and "here to help" and "call on me." Mrs. Holton touched each of their hands and said, "Y'all forgive me. Y'all been kind enough to bring all this food, and here I am acting like I ain't got no manners at all. Please, let's us eat." She stood